Welcome back to the program. For those of us here in the Bay Area, we hear about startups almost every day, but do we ever wonder what it's really like inside those startups? Even harder to imagine is that companies like Apple or HP or even Google, with its 24,000 employees, were once small little startups. With respect to Google, what was it like to be present at the creation? Today we're going to find out from a man who was employee number 59. He is Douglas Edwards. He's a former director of consumer marketing and brand management at Google. It is my pleasure to have him here to talk about his new book, I'm Feeling Lucky, The Confessions of Google Employee Number 59. Douglas Edwards, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you very much for having me on the show.
It's great to have you. One of the things you talk about is how chaotic it was back in those early days in 1998. And hard to imagine that a company that has 24,000 employees or so today was that chaotic and disorganized early on.
Well, you know, it was a real surprise to me. I had been working at the Mercury News for 7 years, and, you know, it's a very traditional newspaper company. It's 150 years old, so they have a lot of process, a lot of hierarchy, and things are pretty much top-down. But coming to Google was quite different.
And what was the first thing that you realized was fundamentally different about this company?
Well, the lack of job descriptions, for one thing, and just the assumption that everybody knew what they should do, and you should find a problem and then solve it and then move on to the next problem. And that was a little different from organizations I'd worked for in the past, where typically, you know, you had unions, and unions had very specific things that they were responsible for, and every employee knew exactly what they could do and what they couldn't do.
The other thing, of course, is that you were coming into the company in the marketing department, an area that that Larry Page and Sergey both thought was unnecessary.
Yeah, they were not all that convinced that marketing was an essential function for the company, certainly not in the early days in terms of growing the audience. They really believed that usage of Google would grow through word of mouth because the product was so good that it was clearly going to be superior to anything else on the market, and that would be enough to get people talking.
There was this idea that if you had to use marketing to sell the product, then you'd failed.
Right. It's a very engineering point of view, which is that you should keep innovating, you should keep improving the product, and as long as the product is the best available, then people will use it. And at the point at which it's not the best available, well, then people shouldn't use it. So, you know, using marketing to kind of bridge that gap and convince people to use something against their best interest would be a concession that you had lost.
Of course, the other part of it was that there weren't clear, absolute metrics as far as marketing was concerned, the way there might be in the realm of engineering.
Exactly. You know, engineers like to know exactly what the effect of their efforts is. And marketing typically, you know, is a little squishier when it comes to reporting on the efficacy of your efforts. And so, I mean, you look at how Google approached its own advertising product and the way that it made sure that every click was counted and that every dollar that you spent on advertising in AdWords or AdWords Select would be carefully tracked and allow you to see how your dollars were performing for you.
You know, we think of Google today as a very sort of extravagant company, but one of the things you talk about is even in those early days, it was very frugal.
Well, the company was very cheap in some areas and seemingly extravagant in others, but when you look closely at what they were extravagant on, there was a very careful cost-benefit analysis done behind things like free meals and massages and all of the perks that were given to the employees. And they realized early on that, for example, providing free lunch and dinner meant that the employees had no reason to leave the building. And so people would pretty much sit down at lunch, talk about work, you know, eat for 20 minutes, and then go back to their desk, whereas, you know, otherwise they would have to leave the place, probably spend an hour on lunch, eat something unhealthy, and forget what they had been talking about or working on when they left.
Was there a sense early on of this shared vision? I mean, you talk a lot about Larry Page as really a visionary looking far out into the future. Was there a sense that he had conveyed this to the people there early on and that everybody had the same shared mission?
Well, I think everyone viewed Google as a force for good, but, you know, the clarity of exactly where Google was going beyond being a search engine was not well communicated. And in fact, when Eric Schmidt came on board, one of the things that he really added to the company was sort of a transparency for the employees into how decisions were made and where the company was heading, you know, mostly translating Larry's vision into more practical terms.
And how important was that to the success of the company? How did that, when Eric Schmidt came in 2001, how did that transform the company?
Well, you know, I mean, it's tough to put a specific evaluation on Eric's contribution to the company. As an employee, I certainly found it easier to operate within Google because Eric was there. But I think the key decisions were still primarily being driven by Larry and Sergey's input. They operated as what they called the troika, the three of them. But I think Larry and Sergey probably were pretty much in alignment most of the time.
One of the things that you talk about that is so, I mean, it seems counterintuitive to much else we think about the company, but this idea that you know, 80% was good enough and that they wanted to get things out there as quickly as possible.
Yeah, that was a real killer for me. That was a philosophy that Orris Holzel, the head of engineering, espoused, which was that, you know, when you get a project to 80% done, move on to the next project because that project was no longer a burning priority, and that last 20% would take too much effort to complete. So it was better to get it out in the public, let the public identify what the most important features to add or the worst bugs to fix were, while you were working on something that, you know, was still at 20 or 30%. So, you know, marketing people tend to like to finish things and polish them. So I had to make some fairly major adjustments in my own attitude to get to the point where I could get things out before they were completely finished.
Did that serve the company well to be in this sort of state of permanent beta?
Well, you know, you can look at the results. Sometimes yes, sometimes no, I think. You look at the launch of something like Buzz, and you think maybe they should have baked it another 20%. But then you look at Gmail, which launches a beta. You look at Google Plus, which is out now and seems to be doing quite well. And I think the urgency, the sense of getting something done and getting it out to the market as quickly as possible, even if it's not perfect, has served Google quite well and is one of the lessons I took from working there, is that it doesn't have to be perfect to go out the door.
One of the other philosophical aspects that's so fascinating is this idea that there was this attitude early on, and partly as a result of who Larry and Sergey were as engineer kind of thinking, that the technology could solve every problem. And at a certain point, they realized, well, maybe it couldn't, that they had the real world out there to rub up against.
Yeah, and early on, you know, that attitude was reinforced because they were able to solve a lot of challenges through application of superior technology. They won the battle to become the biggest search engine. They won the battle to become the biggest advertising online source. And, you know, so I think that gave them a sense of confidence that technology would solve every problem. But then when you run up against things like China, which is much more complex and not a solution, not a problem that can be solved very quickly through just some innovation in code or hardware, I think that was very frustrating for them. And I think they continue to be kind of bedeviled by these more human-influenced problems.
One of the things that you talk about that was the case early on was one, how young everybody was, and two, how smart everybody was.
Yeah, I definitely felt like I was bringing down the curve there.
Talk a little bit about that and how they hired. I mean, they were, as you say, in a permanent state of hiring.
Yeah, and again, this goes back to Orris Holzel, who was the first engineering head and had a policy that, first off, the best thing you could do as an engineer was to hire another engineer because that would essentially double your productivity. And there was no way, no matter how hard you worked as an individual, you could double your productivity in the same way you could by hiring somebody. But, and this was the big caveat, he was very specific, you should only hire people who are as smart as you are or smarter. And, you know, that's a nice guideline, but it's kind of hard to maintain. But they were adamant about it, and they went months without hiring people when they desperately needed them because they just didn't feel the candidates were up to their standards.
And talk a little bit about how that started to play out. I mean, surprisingly, it didn't result in as much infighting as one might have expected.
Yeah, there really wasn't. I mean, one of the qualities that they looked for in engineers was this intellectual curiosity and flexibility about what they worked on. So there was a preference for people who would look at any new development as an exciting new challenge instead of something that would threaten their area of expertise. So there was more of an emphasis on this kind of willingness to engage new problems than there was on someone having exactly the right experience for the problem at hand. And in the book, I make the comparison to kind of stem cells. I mean, people were supposed to reprogram themselves to solve whatever issue came up at the time that was needed.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, some of those were pretty big mistakes. I mean, you talk about some of the reorganization that Larry Page did in terms of engineering and project managers. Some of it was a disaster.
Well, you know, Larry was a young manager and had never really been in an office environment where either he had been managed or had managed others. And so when something wasn't working, and in this case that you referred to, it was project managers who he felt were getting in the way of engineers working on projects that he cared about, he just said, okay, this isn't working, we're going to reboot it, and we're just going to get rid of all the project managers. Which he let them know in a very public meeting with all the engineers. So that didn't go over well either with the project managers, who found out they were no longer needed, or with the engineers, who actually appreciated the role those project managers played in their lives.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that he has matured significantly as a manager between then and today, now back as CEO of the company?
Well, you know, from outside, it looks like he has certainly learned some lessons. You know, I've been watching with interest the fact that he shut down Google Labs, which really surprised me because the Larry Page I knew was big on innovation in terms of, you know, every good idea should be pursued because he never knew when it would pay off. And I think, you know, he's attained a certain maturity as a manager in realizing that, look, we have enough areas that we're working on in terms of development that we should focus our innovation within those existing product lines, as opposed to just continually developing new ideas that you know, for the most part, are not going to go anywhere.
Of course, there's also a different set of issues at stake for the company in terms of the simple economics of it.
Well, yeah, I mean, the premise was always, you know, one of these ideas might turn into a $1 billion industry, and we should pursue, you know, put a certain amount of time into pursuing extreme ideas because one of them might pay off in an extreme way. And the thing is, Google has some products that are already paying off in extreme ways and that need some support and need development to maintain that lead. So I think he's recognizing that, or at least my impression is that he's recognizing that, and has decided that, you know, it's worthwhile keeping these things at the forefront instead of letting them fall behind.
In a company as large as Google has become, can they recapture that sense of, and you know, you talk about it a lot from the early days, that sense of that energy level, that sense of productivity and creativity?
Well, I think Larry and Sergey would, you know, say that they're doing the best that they can to keep that alive. I think it is a challenge. When you have 25,000 people, it is not easy to instill the same sort of entrepreneurial spirit into the company. It's too easy to say, oh, well, if I don't do it, somebody else will do it. And so they do actively work to reward people who are entrepreneurial in nature. I mean, I think you've read about some of these enormous mm-hmm. bonuses they give people, and founder stock option, you know, grants and so forth. So I think they're doing what they can to keep that alive. I just don't know if it's possible with that many people to maintain an entrepreneurial spirit.
What do you think the vision of the company is today, and how has it changed from what it was when you were there?
Well, Larry, you know, has always had a very far-reaching view of what Google could become. And if you go back and look at some of his early interviews, and he's talking about, you know, how it could be, you know, part of your mental process almost. You know, I mean, he's looking beyond just a static search engine. You go to a web page, you put in a search, and you get a result. I think that both he and Sergey have a more science fiction view, you know, of what Google could become as a kind of interface with the world that allows you to understand everything you see around you in a better way and more in context. and therefore make better decisions and better actions as a result of that.
Among those that have been there since the beginning, is there a kind of nostalgia for the old days?
Well, you know, I heard from a few people about who had read my book who were quite wistful for some of those earlier days. And, you know, when I left in 2005, I mean, one of the reasons was it had become a different place to be and lost some of that intimacy and some of the whimsical nature that happens when you have fewer than 100 people working on something. I think there's probably a little bit of nostalgia, and certainly among the earliest employees, for the good old days.
Mm-hmm. And is that damaging in some way, that nostalgia, do you think?
You know, they're still there. A lot of them are still there. When I ask them why, because they're not financially motivated at this point, they tell me that they really enjoy what they do, and especially the engineers. They say, you know, if you're going to do engineering, there's no better place to do it than Google. They have the best software, the best engineers. They have access to more data than anyone else. And so they're not particularly interested in leaving. You know, I think they recognize the company has changed a lot, and some of them sound a little less satisfied than they used to. But, you know, they've been there 12 years. That's a long time to be in one place.
Right. How have they responded to the company kind of under siege? I mean, attacking, you know, the do no evil and of course, the whole privacy issue and the aggregation of information and of course, China, all the things that the company has been under siege about.
Well, you know, I talk in the book about some of the earliest instances where Google came under attack. And one of them was this launch of what became Google Groups. They bought the company Deja News and they took it offline because the software that they bought was not terribly robust, and so they were going to retool it. And people just flamed them. You know, I mean, they were outraged that Google would take this archive offline, even though we announced that we were taking it offline to make it better. And so I think that was a key incident where they came to realize that, you know, people just don't get it, and so we're going to do what the right thing is. And people will eventually catch up, and they'll get it, you know, at some point down the road. And you see that attitude throughout Google's history. I mean, everything from scanning books to, you know, putting ads in Gmail. You know, this notion that, you know, okay, we're a little bit ahead of the curve here. People will eventually see it's not a bad thing or that it's a good thing, and then they'll be okay with it. They don't always get there. People don't always figure that out on their own.
And, of course, a lot of it is still in play. A lot of it, the jury is still out.
Yes. Yeah, certainly with, you know, the book scanning project, which, you know, was very near and dear to Larry in particular. I mean, as early as 2000, he was talking about, I mean, we need to scan every book in the Library of Congress or every book in the world. And to him, it was just a clear imperative that this would be for the betterment of mankind, that having all of this information at your fingertips available, you know, with a quick search, how could you see any downside to that? And I think he probably still doesn't understand why people are so upset about it,
mm-hmm.
because in his mind, it's a net plus.
What are the challenges on the marketing side for the company today, do you think?
Well, you know, they've gotten a little more comfortable with marketing. I mean, they ran a Super Bowl spot, which
right.
back when I was there was something we used to joke about as anathema. We would never do something like that because it's so untargeted and unmeasurable in terms of its results. So I think they've come to embrace marketing more as a discipline and have put into place some, you know, an organization to support that. It is harder when you're a big company, when you're seen as Goliath instead of David, to maintain the same level of brand loyalty.
How do they look upon some of the new startups today? I mean, is there this wistfulness that sort of hearkening back again to the old days?
Well, you know, you have to look at what they've done about participating in the kind of startup environment, and they have a venture capital arm now that's quite active, that is investing heavily in startups. And so they still have a finger in that in that pie. I mean, they don't want somebody to develop a new technology at a startup that they're unaware of and then all of a sudden grow to become a competitor. So I think they're keeping an eye on developments among startups and trying to play a role or at least have access to the technology if it turns out to be something worthwhile.
Douglas Edwards, his book is I'm Feeling Lucky, The Confessions of Google Employee Number 59. Doug, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
I enjoyed it. Thank you for having me on.
Thank you.